Welcome to another season of Debt Review with Dummies. And by dummies, we refer to your hosts. I am Corey, the dummiest dummy.
And I'm Zach. I'm so dumb, I once got hit by a parked car.
Zach, what is Debt Review with Dummies?
Corey, this podcast is all about debt review, getting to understand what it is, and talking to some of the people involved in the industry of debt review and people who've been through the debt review process so that you can really learn whether this is a process that's right for you, or if you're interested in the process, you can learn a little more about the history of the process or perhaps how things are being done right now. We love debt review, and this podcast is about debt review.
Well, to kick off the season of Debt Review with Dummies, Zach, who are you talking to today?
Yeah, we thought we'd take the opportunity to bring in someone from the industry who's been around for a number of years, and they work with one of the biggest brands, you could say, within the debt review space. So we're going to talk to Mr. Binay Sega of Debt Busters. Perhaps you've heard of them. We'll get him in here in a moment. But Binay is a very hardworking person in our industry, leading one of the main brands in our industry. They see a lot of information, and one of the things we really enjoy about them is how public they are with their stats. They're always sharing their information with people to try to help them get a better understanding of who needs debt review, how things are going in debt review, and the progress that's been made in the industry. So, yeah, quite exciting episode.
We are very, very blessed today to have Binay Sega from Debt Busters with us in the podcast. Binay, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time. And let's fire away. Just give us a bit of background of who you are and where did your debt review journey start?
Thanks, Corey and Zach, for having me. Like I was just telling you a minute ago, my first ever podcast. Thanks for making me feel very much at home. I'm actually thinking about it. I'm now in the industry for about 12 years. Started in 2013. How it started was I started at Debt Busters. I was looking for my next role to have a serious sense of meaning, not that my previous roles didn't. And I wanted to do something in the retail or personal finance space. The former CEO of Debt Busters approached me, and we had a few conversations, flew down, met the management team. I used to live in Joburg then, met the management team, I was like, wow, this is quite an amazing sort of business in terms of what they do to help people. I was having difficulty, like, research where else in the world such things exist. And actually, I realized we've got quite a unique system in SA, very well set up system, in fact. And I know this is topical because Zach and his team has also had an article out just last week about the different sort of countries and the systems that they've got. Anyway, I really like what I saw, and I signed on, and I'm here still 12 years later. I'm very happy to be here. And I think over those years, it's been great to see the industry grow, help many more people, help many more creditors get a lot of money back with the hope that that money is going to be put into actually productive use. You know, as you guys know, banks and lenders have to lend. And the quicker we can get the money, it's an effective, you know, way of recouping that money for them, the quicker they should, in theory, in any case, lend that money to particularly small businesses. And, you know, one of the gaps we've got here is small business lending in SA. It's a huge gap. So our hope is that with helping more people repay their debt quicker, that money cycles through and, you know, it gets lent four or five times over that period, as opposed to sitting dormant or not being recouped at all. And by the way, I mean, if I could just, I know I'm taking a lot of time to do an intro, but one of the things we really would like is to expand what debt counselors are allowed to do in terms of, you know, restructuring debt. And I think for me, one of the more fundamental things is, having looked at some of these things from Zach's article as well, but having an understanding of overseas, being able to restructure monies owed that is outside of the gambit of the National Credit Act. I think there's a big gap there. our ability to restructure, renegotiate, get those things repaid back. If we could get, for example, debt owed to municipalities, I haven't seen, since basically the middle of last year, I haven't gone one day where in my article feed there wasn't an article about this. Now, it could be that all the same articles get recycled, but it's such a huge topic. So, I think we've got an opportunity. The sky's the limit, the way I see it.
And of course, ultimately, we're helping consumers, So I think it's a wonderful, you're right, it's a wonderful industry. And we've got a lovely system here in South Africa. Corey and I couldn't be more in love with Debt Review if we tried. But all right. Okay. So you work now for one of the, shall we say, national debt counselors. Are you also part of an association? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I'm part of an association. That's correct. It's called National Debt Counseling Association. You may wonder where the name comes from. It comes exactly from that. It's we had set it up by a number of companies of national or national plus size, this was all the way back in 2016, 2017. You may recall back then, I think there were some significant changes. One of the shortcomings of our act, you can call it a curse or a blessing, is that the debt counseling section, it looks like it was written by a guy in the last 5 minutes of a five-hour exam. When you read through a lot of the things, it was really rushed. What happened there was, I think a lot of things weren't clearly well thought through. So you have a lot of gaps. So one of those was essentially understanding, well, what is the role of a debt counselor? What is a debt counselor meant to do? And I think that around 2015, 2016, the regulator as well as others were looking a more closer look at it. And we realized actually, the setups can lend themselves to growing the industry significantly, but it has to be done the right way. And I think talking to some like-minded individuals, scale is what we bring to the table. And I think there's certainly a role for, sitting across the table for with a consumer and talking through finances and all of that. What you don't get, that you get the personal touch and the attention. What you don't get with that is scale. And the ability to lower the cost of doing whatever it is that you're doing to the consumers. And our view was that with the association, there was clearly a break between two, let's call it two opposites, smaller, sort of more face-to-face debt counseling versus larger with the well-educated, registered debt counselors type big sort of setups. And we felt that there wasn't a home for the larger businesses that turned out to be, many of the members of the National Debt Counseling Association. And in 2017, we applied and got the permit for a nonprofit organization and so on and got going with that. Association is got 8 members at the moment. I think people can check out ndca.org.za, don't need to name that members. But I think it's basically larger scale entities that can bring scale. And probably, in our view, that we're probably talking to 50% of the debt counseling population out there on a regular basis, if not more. And I think there's a lot of insight that comes with that. And our hope is that we can continue to participate and contribute to the betterment of the industry for all of credit. That's, the credit industry. That's our view.
Well, one of the things that we see you have been talking about recently, and maybe it's something we can dive into a little bit now, is that it's February. People have survived through the 78 days of January, and now they're starting to think about their debt situation. And we see that you're also sharing a message about National Debt Awareness Month.
So Zach, you are correct that January is the longest year of 2025. And I think it's going to be the longest year of every year, unfortunately. I'm saying that, of course, with a bit tongue in cheek. Recently, I've spoken with some people who run similar businesses in other jurisdictions and asked them, well, what is your busiest month? And guess what? January, just like us. So I think it's a global thing. And what's really happened is, I think over the last 10 plus years, particularly since the global financial crisis, what you've seen is debt, personal debt, and how it evolved for people. A lot of people across the world, for various reasons, have felt the pinch. And I think in many, many places, the saving grace has been tapping into credit. But what comes with that is that, you know, if your incomes are not growing, which is certainly the case that we found ourselves in SA, your ability to repay that debt quickly becomes harder and harder. And what we realized around 2020 was, this is a taboo topic. You know, no one sits around the briar and says, hey, how much is your debt? You know, what is my debt? Oh, you have this credit card. I mean, it's not really a topic. But the reality is that it's this this awkward situation. You know, at some point, you know, there is a conversation about money, and you kind of skirt around the fact that, oh, okay, well, maybe a lot of the things that you think people have bought are bought on debt or credit, rather. And I think here also we need to make the distinction between credit and debt. You know, often people ask, well, how do you become, what's credit versus what's debt? Well, it's the same exact thing. It's just that we somehow have the inkling in the English language to call something with a different name when it turns on us. And credit is one of those things. When it becomes burdensome, we're like, oh, no, it's not credit anymore. It's debt. You know, as if it's like somehow morphed into some beast that we don't know about. Reality is the money is still the money. So what we realized was there's certainly a bit of lack of awareness, but the biggest gap is actually that the subject is not one that people want to talk about. So we thought in 2020, let's have a debt awareness month. And we started that particularly to bring the topic so that people can talk, start talking about it, start facing it. And this year, it's the, let's see if I can do my sums, from 2020 to 2025, this must be the sixth year then. I had to do it as well. It's a bit tricky because you think 25 minus 20 is 5, but then you forget about the 20. So we want it to be eventually a global conversation. Because it's so much like that everywhere in the world. The reality is it's a great time to also take a step back and look at your finances and see. And I think what we're trying to do is make it a bit less scary. It's a scary topic and it's a lonely topic. So what we're trying to do this year is share some of the success stories of real people, you know, people who've been through the journey of the debt counseling journey, who have completed it and what tips they have to share with it. And I mean, you will see some of this, you know, that will happen over the next few weeks. These are real people who've actually gone through it and they've got fantastic stories to tell about how it revolutionized their time. I mean, if I can digress, one of my good friends from my former employer called me out of the blue about 6 years ago. And so I said, hey, what's up? And by that stage, she had changed jobs. They had bought the dream house. Then they were, I'm sharing a particular very sort of personal story without giving names. And they had a couple of times, there was a home invasion. And they felt no longer safe in their home. So they basically had to sell in a hurry, but they accumulated a lot of debt. So now you have a lot of debt shortfall. You don't have a house anymore and whatever. And she was like, can you help me? Both her and her husband signed on. They finished. She said to me like 1 week later, I cut up all my credit cards. I was so overjoyed. I didn't know such a thing existed in terms of what you people do. And her journey was one of basically acceleration. They finished around 3 years later. subsequently, they changed jobs and all of that, and now she's the global head of one of the largest companies in that field. She's the global head of HR, and they subsequently moved to the States, her and her family, for different reasons, not for this, not running away from that, but she's been super happy. So that clean break that comes with, okay, I'm going to pause now, I'm going to breathe. And in the UK, they have something called the breathing space, by the way. It's almost like a pause. You give someone 30 days or something of almost like freezing the debt repayments. I think it's 30 or 60 days, which I think is actually a brilliant idea. So everything freezes. It's almost like a Mr. Freeze situation. You're just going to freeze everything for a little bit. But sometimes that's what people need. You know, you need a bit of a pause. You just need to reflect. So I think what we're trying to do this year is share the real stories of these debt heroes. And from a debt busters perspective, because we were the first ones to start it, I'm also pleased to say that we have surpassed over 1 million online subscribers who are actively logging in and managing their debt, seeing their credit scores, playing with the different tools and all of that. So we also thought it's a great reason to celebrate that and create people some breathing room, give them the opportunity to talk to each other, and see where it goes. I think the sooner we face it, the better off all of us are. You know, a decision you make today is going to be better than any decision you may make tomorrow. I think that's the way to see how you deal with, you know, credit in the end. So I think the most important message for this year is one of recognizing that whichever way you're feeling is how a hero should feel. Often heroes also have feelings. You just don't know about them because they don't show that to you on TV. Superman never takes a break, right? He's just flying all over the place. In fact, I've never seen him even drink coffee. I don't know how he gets his energy. But everyone needs a bit of a pause. So I think we're just trying to give people that space this year.
Yeah, Zach and I have also been blessed for the last 2 years to have been telling some real good stories about consumers that's gone through the process. And that was the idea, is to actually share those feel-good stories. I think it's a great idea, Vinay. So you kind of hinted and touched on it, but what do you think is the biggest misconceptions about debt? And then I want to take it a little bit further and say, what is the biggest misconceptions around debt review in South Africa?
I think the biggest thing about misconception about debt is that it won't happen to me. You know, I sit here today, it's not mine, it's someone else's thing. Like, it won't happen to me. But life turns on it, you know, on its head. Things can turn on a dime without you even realizing it, just like that. I mean, right now, as we sit here, I've got a very close friend who is in hospital, who's been there since the middle of November. He unfortunately was in he was hit by a drunk driver. He had a successful business. He was hit by a drunk driver. Doesn't recall much of it. Had to be airlifted out of the car. Taken to the hospital, and after several surgeries, several complications, he's making a recovery, but just close. And now he's, gone 3 months without any serious income. He had a small business, still going, but he's in need of help. You know, my point in saying this is that things can happen to you without you realizing, just on a dime, things turn. I think that's the biggest misconception. Incomes can be cut, interest rates can change, all of this can happen. And I think when we think about, avenues available to you when something unexpected happens to you. If you had been planning and you have the right insurances, you know, you have income protection and all of that, you may be okay. And that's great. And I think we must get that message out. If everyone could afford, I would say, you always ask me, what's like the one product I should get? I always say, if you can afford it, get income protection. Reality is not everyone can afford it. Not everyone knows about it. And not everyone is going to buy into the fact that, you know what, why should I pay for something, you know, protect my income? But things do happen. So if everyone could do it, then I would say go and do that. That's like the one thing. Reality is that's not going to happen. But when you are faced with something that you don't expect, what are the options? In our context, And there aren't many. You know, you can let your debt slip, you can let it grow and whatever, and it becomes worse and worse. Debt counseling, the way that it was envisioned, is a brilliant mechanism to allow you to pay back your expensive debt quicker. And that's the point. Often we're dealing with, I was looking at some stats last night. On average, right now, we're dealing with 26.4% interest rate of the incoming personal loans and credit cards and, you know, everything that we would bundle on the unsecured debt. Now, what can you do with that debt money instead of paying it over to interest? You can do a lot with that money. Often the money taken on is expensive. And so one of the other misconceptions, I would say, is that it takes very long. It actually doesn't. I think if you're serious about paying back any debt that you've got and you're willing to make some significant behavioral changes, I think you can deal with it within a matter of, let's call it 24 to 48 months. It's not guaranteed, but I think where we also see people having the incorrect idea is that debt counseling or debt review is only for people who are heavily in arrears. In fact, that is quite the opposite. And I think the way that it was envisioned in the Act, if you read it, of course, it's all legalese and it's difficult for some of us to, but it says, if you are feeling financial, the way that I would translate it is debt counseling as people who are feeling an acute need of restructuring their debts right now, or who will need to restructure their debts soon because they know that they will not be able to handle it. I think that's the gist of it. So if you remove the counseling part and focus on what's the technical thing that we're doing, we're restructuring people's debt repayments, okay? This is a global phenomenon, and people restructure personal debts, people restructure business debts. This happens all the time. So I think the way to think about it is it's a mechanism to help renegotiate by raising your hand and saying, hey, I need a breathing space. I'm unable to pay what you wanted me to pay. And let's restructure it. It's a negotiation. So, it requires the behavioral change. And one must go into it thinking I'm fully committed, you know, for the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You can't look back and, you know, continuously say, hey, what's over there? Maybe I should have taken that loan or whatever. I think when you need to be fully committed. So I think the ability to repay your debt quicker than you thought, the ability to actually restructure in a meaningful way, I think those are some misconceptions that people have. And they always think, you know, it's only for low income people. Well, that couldn't be farther from the truth. What we found is I think it's harder to make it work for the lower incomes, particularly because they're generally more susceptible to unexpected shocks. Whereas with the higher incomes, they will have some sort of, money saved somewhere and whatever, that they can deal with the external shocks a little bit better. But it's for anyone, you know, always say people, we have people on the books who pay as little as 800 Rand, and we have people on the books who pay as much as 120,000 Rand. You know, there's such a big range of individuals. You can make it work. I think it's about, it's just the, you know, the mindset and the what follows on is the behaviors. It's about changing those.
Now, you mentioned that you were looking at some stats, and this is something that your organization is very well known for, is sharing its stats. It's one of the things we really admire about your openness with the market. And of course, it's very insightful because you speak to so many people, as you mentioned, about their debt. So if you just think about how South Africa and the debt landscape have changed recently, what's something new that you're seeing now, or changes that maybe weren't as obvious before?
I think COVID was not to sound cliche, but COVID was a big game changer in the way that I think people have kind of organized themselves, their families, their finances, you know, kind of dealt with everything. If we focus on that, because I think going back in history is not really helpful, but I think if we just focus on that, since that time, what's happened? I think the one thing that is very significant is, well, maybe it's two things in the same. One is income growth has slowed down significantly. In most cases, actually is below, you know, our basic CPI. So that's its effect that's happened. For some income groups, I think 2024 was good, and not to give too much away, we launching the Q4 debt index actually tomorrow. So again, you'll see all the stats. So some of the higher income groups did better in 2024 than they did in 2023. But on the scale, if you look at the last several years, you know, the income growth was far, far below what it should be in terms of keeping up with the cost of living. So we actually do have a cost of living crisis. We haven't actually called it that. In many parts of the world, people have. We haven't called it, but it's real for us. And I think, you know, it hits us hard because very little of the inflation, in my opinion, that is inherited in South Africa comes from South Africa. I think a lot of it is exported. Whether it's big countries printing a lot of money and that money needing to find a home and coming to the JSE in terms of investments, or whether it's tariffs, you know, or whether it's some other means, often is that. I think our biggest driver is, of course, petrol. Whatever happens to petrol price really is a leading indicator to what's going to happen. And guess what we don't have naturally in South Africa? We don't have petrol. It has to come from somewhere else, whether it's crude or, you know, refined. It has to come here. So we're a bit beholden to that, which is very significant, unfortunately. I think it's great that we actually produce almost all of our food, because that is some of those things are within our control. But then, you know, that food also has to be distributed and all of that. So, but when you look at the CPI, and then you say, okay, well, for our income groups, you know, what are the important things that where the prices have gone up? And it's actually, if you take a step back and look at the important things, which is not always food, important things, then, you know, medical aid payments, private school fees, all of these things have grown probably at double the rate. If CPI is 6%, they've grown at 12% per annum for the last 5-6 years. I think there was 1 year immediately after COVID where we all felt good because, you know, our medical aids did not really increase in price. But I think we all know that that difference was made up the following year in a big time. And same with electricity. So coming back, I think it's, to Zach's question. So one significant shift is that income growth has really lagged. Whereas if you go back, let's say, 10 years, in the early, let's call it 2000 to 2015, it was probably particularly, you know, in terms of the increases given to civil servants, they were generally above CPI. Now it's actually at best at CPI or lower. So that's one big trend. The second one is that because of COVID and just before the pandemic, there was this thing called a debt intervention bill that's gone through all through Parliament and, you know, it kind of really didn't go anywhere. But what happened was that scared off, I think, a lot of lenders in the sense that if we lend to a particular low-income group, we're going to get that debt written off, so we're going to stop lending to them. And the lending to particularly those earning below 5,000 Rand, which is majority of our population, has completely stopped. I mean, it's like, you know, very, 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 very small amount compared to what it was before. But instead, since COVID, you know, the prospect of lending has also diminished for many others. And in the end, the economy, because it hasn't grown, let's call it the attractive lending prospects for many lenders has shrunk or actually stayed the same. We can also throw into the mix other drivers such as immigration and so on. I really don't think those are significant figures to worry about when it comes to the lending landscape. They're tiny, if at all there's any effect. But what happened is that the number of eligible, well-paying customers who lenders, particularly banks, would want to lend to, either did not grow at all or it went backwards. And in the end, what that meant was often these are higher income individuals. there has been a higher rate of lending to a smaller group of people. So what we've seen is particularly those taking home above 30,000-35,000 rand, their stockpiles of debt, especially unsecured debt, has skyrocketed compared to before. So that's the second significant change that we've seen since 2020. And I think I said it's actually two, but one, they're really linked to each other, you know, in a way. So how do we solve this? We solve it with growth. I think simply put, economic growth. We need more people to, we need more people to have full-time jobs in the economy. We need more money to turn around. We need to bring in many more of the youngsters who will become attractive lending prospects and contribute to the formal economy. That's the way to solve it, but that is not a simple solution. It's probably we must also think about it. It's multi-decade and multi-generational solution. It's not a single generational solution. I think we're already in the thick of things, and it's very easy to kind of look back and feel demotivated and down. Reality is that the credit landscape in South Africa today is far more vibrant than it was 30 years ago. It's far more open, far more transparent, and, you know, it's far bigger than it would have been otherwise. So I think, you know, from that perspective, NCA has been amazing, but there's still a lot of room to grow into when it comes to the growth of the economy, getting more people and all of that. So I've given you a very long answer, but I think those are two significant trends that we should be aware of, because it also impacts lending. It impacts, how people behave. It impacts how much money they have to invest. So it's a bit of a, you know, circular argument. I think those are the two significant shifts.
So, Bene, if we can kind of look at consumer behavior and financial education in the debt review space, what are the common mistakes that consumers make to become over-indebted, and how can they avoid getting over-indebted?
Yeah, because I think you mentioned, life is unpredictable. So we understand a lot of the people that we end up helping have had that happen to them. But if we take that away, what else are we talking about here?
This is not going to endear me to some of the colleagues who are in the business of lending for vehicles. But simply put, the number one difference between becoming a well-to-do, prosperous South African, when you're young, I'm talking now 25 to 30 years old, when you are earning, let's say, 15 to 20,000 rand per month, the number one thing that's going to stop you from going to the next level financially and feeling like you've got your finances in control is to get into a vehicle finance agreement that you don't understand, and getting into a vehicle finance agreement that is going to take up a big chunk of your money with a big balloon payment at the end where you have to surrender the car without understanding. It's simply put, that is the number one impediment to us growing our middle income. And like I said, this is not going to endear me, because I also understand people need cars. So I'm not saying don't go and borrow for a car. But what I said very clearly is getting into a finance agreement that you don't understand. So understand it fully. Understand what you're going to have at the end. And, you know, get a car that is within your means. Don't overstretch yourself. So in the end, you can get from point A to point B with any car. About 2 years ago, I stopped more or less driving. I think Zach knows. So, I mean, these days I use Uber partly because, I find it very convenient, and partly because I don't particularly enjoy driving, but that's just me. My point is that there are alternatives and I think these days our trains and whatever are also making a comeback for many of the metros. I think a lot of the local governments have done a great job in terms of getting back public transport services. I know we have some of the difficulties there, but I would say that is the single thing. So if you need a car, absolutely get one, but get one that is not going to eat up all your salary. Factor in what you're going to need for maintenance. Factor in how much your tires are going to cost when you need to replace them. Factor in how much insurance you're going to need and all of that. We often hear from people who don't factor in something like an insurance. They're like, oh, I didn't know I needed it. Well, you are generally told that you need it. But then it becomes another expense that's necessary, because if you don't have insurance and then you get into some trouble, then actually all of that is on you. So, and also, most importantly, understand what your balloon is, if there is one, what you're going to be liable for at the end, and what are you going to walk away from in 4 years' time or 5 years' time when you finish. So I would say that it's just the single, the number one thing we can do to help ourselves is to like understand that. I would say an overwhelming majority of cases can be avoided if people fully understood what they're getting themselves into when it comes to vehicles. I know it's simply put, but I'm just trying to simplify also for our audience.
Yeah. Well, look, I think what we're going back to again is financial education, right? I would say we all have concerns about the level of financial education in South Africa across, you know, all demographics and age groups. It hasn't particularly gotten better over the years. A lot of people now, if they're looking for financial education, they are on TikTok trying to find some advice. That's a little scary. Do you think that financial education is the key to dealing with debt in South Africa? Do you think that's one of the things that could be a real big driver?
I mean, Zach, this is quite an interesting question, and it's like asking someone, do you like puppies? I think nobody's going to say, like, I don't like puppies. Of course, financial education is important. For me, actually, the number one education that comes is for you to watch your parents and watch what your parents do with their money. And I think our biggest gap currently is that not enough of that is happening, you know, in terms of our kids learning. And of course, those kids are going to grow up and become adults. So it's the role modeling. What are we role modeling for our kids when it comes to finances? It's very important. It's harder to do in this environment because we don't walk into shops and pay for things via cash. We're using credit. I think in some cases we may even be using crypto. So the invisibility of credit makes it difficult to role model for the future generations. Yes, one can spend a lot of money on financial education, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, but I think it's only relevant. Financial education is only relevant when you are in a situation where you can, as an adult, role play and go through what you're experiencing. And often this comes with the very first paycheck that you get. What do you do with that amount? That is actually when you need, that should be, if there's only one time, if there's only 15 minutes of your time we can have for you to learn about financial education and how not to waste your money, it must be during the day where you get your first paycheck. Because then you're going to go and either overcommit and then get yourself in a situation where you cannot get out of, or you're going to take a step back and put something aside. So I think what we're lacking is just the targeted version of financial education. Financial education is broad, could be a lot of different things, and it could be a lot of things that no one really needs. So I would say, like, going back to two things. One is role modeling, how we manage our finances for our kids, taking them with to the shops and whatever, but actually trying to teach them the basics of how to manage cash. That's quite important. And number two is somehow getting to the young people when they get their first paycheck or second paycheck, whatever, early on in their careers, catching them and saying, hey, what are you going to do with that first paycheck? You know, I think HR departments can play a significant role with that, to have, you know, very specifically targeted. And I must admit that I haven't really seen this done successfully, you know, in my former career as well. It's not a thing, you know, and I think that's where a lot of HR or people departments can really earn their badges, by targeting early stage people and helping them, you know, effectively use their money and not squander them, you know, to the things. So that's what I would say.
So when you focusing on vehicle finance, which you mentioned earlier, what I found in my experience when I speak to people, I ask them how much they pay on interest. What's the interest rate when they get to vehicles? And 99% of people don't even know what the interest rate is on the vehicle. So in your opinion, what do you think is important when you buy a vehicle in terms of fixed rate or linked rate? What would you suggest if someone had to go buy a vehicle today?
Ooh, that's a juicy question. I like it. I think the reality is many of the people who want to get a car are not going to be makers, but they're going to be takers of whatever is being offered to them. I think, Corey, from a practical perspective, my sense is many of the vehicle finance agreements that is on offer today will be something that's linked to the repurchase rate. I mean, I think you'll be pretty hard pressed. If you are going to look for fixed, then you're going to pay for the premium. I mean, that's just how it is. Perhaps that is not the most important thing, but perhaps the most important thing is what you mentioned about interest rate and what does that actually mean. Again, going back to the stats, so let me ask you guys a question. What's the average finance vehicle agreement interest rate today?
What would you say? 13%.
13? Yeah. Zach?
Yeah, you're right. I think you're not far off there, Corey. Maybe even you get it a little bit lower, but you're at the mercy of whoever's selling you the car. And you're at that point of desperation where you almost have the secret hope that they won't find out that your finances can't let you afford this car. So you almost take anything that they offer you.
Yeah, the average we're seeing now is around 16%, 15.5%, 16%, which is, you know, it's not the worst that we've seen, but it's also not the best. But I think if you think about the typical vehicle conversation, is it's not about like what interest rate can you afford. It's like how much, what are you looking to spend per month? That's the biggest trick, because then they're going to make the numbers work. So if you say I'm willing to spend 5,000 Rand, mathematically that can be worked out. You know, I can give you a Mercedes G-Class for 5,000 Rand, perhaps for 25 years if you want, you know, for example. I probably could. I'm not saying that it's impractical because of the useful life of the car and all of that, but it could be done. You know, anything could be done. What you don't know is that amount that you quoted, one, is that realistic? How much is that going to leave you? That should never be more than, let's say, 30% of your take-home pay. And I think for many people, they will treat it as, and it will be more. And two, more importantly, when you're having that conversation, how certain are you that you're going to have that income in 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever? How are you building in, you know, that's just the vehicle payment. How are you building in your insurance? What is, you know, how much is a typical insurance on a car? Let's call it somewhere between 500 to 2,000 Rand. I mean, it's a broad range, but let's just take an average. Let's say it's 1,000 Rand a month. How are you factoring that in into the new vehicle? How are you factoring, like, you know, your maintenance stuff? I mean, I know some people who own fancy cars who didn't realize a set of tires in the front were different than the set of tires in the back. And subsequently, a set of tires for the back cost something like 12,000 Rand, and you have to get them replaced every few years. Now, that's not something that the dealership is going to tell you, or anyone for that matter. It's, you know, you have to do. So I think it's vehicles is a very sensitive topic, as you can see to me as well. And again, just going back, not suggesting people mustn't take cars, because it's very aspirational. It's very important. And it is an important lever in terms of allowing us to leap into more the middle to high income country. But I think it's very, very important that we understand the significance of what we're going to commit ourselves to when it comes to the vehicles. And, you know, if you can bargain on the interest rate, you should. And I think what you're hinting at is often people don't think they can, you know, negotiate, but they can. Try it. You know, don't take the first thing that's presented to you. Back, sleep on it. Think about it. Look for alternatives, whatever. These days, there are lots of different types of cars. I think there's great used cars and so on. You can get fantastic value. So, you know, I think lots of considerations. But again, coming back, for me, actually, if I think about it, again, for a young person, 25 to 30, I mean, all of us are young, but none of us are 25 to 30 on this call. That is the biggest decision you're going to make during that five-year period is how much of your income and future income, by the way, are you committing to paying off a vehicle that you may not own in 4 or 5 years' time? That is the biggest question. That is what's going to make you fly in your 30s or really sort of suffer in your 30s.
Well, Lanai, I think that's very sound advice. And we can see as a debt counselor, you think about these things as debt counselors. These are the things that we're kind of having these conversations, but often retrospectively with people. Now we're going back and looking at maybe mistakes that were made. And we often wish we could have had that conversation a few years before. So good advice. Let's talk debt reviews, since you love debt review as much as we do. It's been around for a while now. I think it's established. I think we all perhaps agree that there's still not enough understanding about it. There's still not enough people taking advantage of the opportunity it presents them. But if you go back a little bit from when you started to today, is debt review today better than it's ever been?
I want to almost say, you remember there was a very funny episode with Mr. Bill Clinton where he was defending himself and he said, it depends on what the definition of the word is. So depends on what the definition of better is. Better for who? I think we need to take a step back and realize that there are multiple parties in our debt counseling journey. There's, of course, the consumer who wants to pay off their expensive debt as quickly as possible and go back into borrowing mode as quickly as possible. That is the number one motivation for the consumer. The second big party is the creditor who wants to get their money back as quickly as possible. And often we don't give enough credit to, pun intended, to creditors, but we must, that they take significant haircuts, so to speak. They forego future interest and whatever payments in the South African landscape to make debt repayments, debt restructuring work. So you have to think about them as a significant party. You have to think about the debt counselor who is going to source leads, find leads, you know, talk to people, convince some of them to sign on to debt counseling, take on the risk that that you know a certain percent of those individuals will never make a payment, and take a risk that some of them will fall off, and all of those things. There is the debt counselor who is often also employing a number of very qualified people to make this process work, which is still somewhat manual. There is the there are the credit bureaus who are involved, whose job is to, you know, essentially issue monikers on people's performance, if I can put it like that. That's what they do every month. They kind of gauge you, kind of like some of your you know, vitality things, saying you didn't run enough, which is kind of what mine tells me, by the way, every week. It's like, you didn't move enough, you didn't walk enough, you didn't run enough. But that's what they do. Their job is to make sure that the data is reflected accurately. And they rely a lot on the debt counselors as well as creditors. And there's the National Credit Regulator, who has a mammoth job, with only 150 people to govern the credit landscape of a country with 60 odd million consumers, or 60 odd million population, probably 30 odd million consumers. I mean, it's a huge job, and you know, definitely not enough. Don't have anywhere near the resources they need. In my opinion, they need 10 times the resources to be very effective. But they tried their best to kind of be everywhere and everything, you know, attend to all these things. You have the National Consumer Tribunal, who've got interest in place because, you know, they oversee some of these things, and they're also along with NCR, they were created with the NCA. You have your group of attorneys who you know, have to participate somehow, sometime, you know, in terms of getting the legal portion of the debt restructuring process going. Then you have your system providers, who are all kinds of system providers, providing either, like, you know, software to the DCs or software to the credit providers or whatever, whatever. Then you have your PDAs, whose job is very, very, very stressful. Collect and distribute. Don't make any mistakes. Make sure every cent finds its way to where it needs to go. So you have to then take a step back. These are, I don't know, I didn't count, but 7 or 8 different constituents who've got something at stake. So is debt review better for all of them today compared to 10 years ago? I don't know. I think some of them would differ, you know, depending on who you ask. But if we actually, and I'm glad you asked the question, because we have to take a systems view on this. If you think holistically for the entire system, for the entire ecosystem, is it better in you know, I would say absolutely yes. Some people will feel like they are not doing better than they did 10 years ago. And some people will feel like they're doing much better. You know, for example, from a credit provider perspective, they're getting a lot of money back. And they get a lot of money back more quickly. You know, even within the credit providers, the people who are running debt review departments are delighted with that. The people who are running, you know, credit risk departments are horrified because they're like, well, why are all these people ending up in debt review? They shouldn't be going. And as you guys know, last year was the pinnacle, hopefully, I'm saying hopefully with a bit tongue in cheek, of, you know, significant negative marketing about debt counseling across the board by 3 banks in particular, which none of us enjoyed. But we can also understand where that's coming from. So, you know, I think if you go back to the question and say, well, is debt review today better in terms of that? Yes, I think my answer is we can push through many more people than we could more effectively and look at an outcome, you know, more effectively. Are more people finishing debt review compared to 2008, 2009, you know, in terms of who's starting and finishing? The answer is we hope they are. I think there's, you know, as a percentage, the deals are generally better for the consumer, particularly, you know, because of DCRS and the huge, again, huge effort and sacrifice that creditors are making to make that work. Money is being recouped much more effectively by the PDS. That's without a doubt. The cost to the consumer in real terms is far lower than it was before in real terms. And by the way, I mean, we've done some benchmarking. You know that in some countries, the debt counselor equivalent for their fees would take somewhere between 40 to 50% of all repayments made back to creditors. In SA, we're sitting somewhere between 8 to 10% when you look at the full, you know, life cycle, 5-year or so life cycle, which is for the services that is being provided. I think that's phenomenal. So I think, you know, sometimes you may hear that people say, oh, it's too expensive and so on. Well, there is a cost of restructuring someone's debt agreements. And where we are as debt counselors most effective is when someone has a lending relationship with multiple parties. And in most, an overwhelming number of cases, that will be the case in South Africa. That is the most effective thing is to take over and negotiate on behalf of a consumer all the credit agreements going forward. Now, you know, there are some instances where, of course, consumers can do this on their own with, let's say, one lender or whatever it might be. But we're talking about, you know, very few cases, in my opinion, where you would see that. So, are there improvements that we need to make? Absolutely. And I think now if I talk, you know, in terms of like from an association and members view, we have very clear views. Firstly, I think the entire National Credit Act needs to become much more customer-centric, much more than it is today. We don't believe it's customer-centric enough when it comes to, the debt counseling section. For example, you must provide consumers a number of days, what we call a cooling off period. You know, this is done for other credit agreements and other agreements. So, you know, I don't understand why it cannot be done for debt counseling. It's the same thing. That doesn't, you know, cater for it. It must allow companies and individuals to register as, let's call them debt restructurers or debt counselors. I mean, the name is a bit of a misnomer, but for the longevity of the industry and continuity of business practices, that must be, you know, that must become a thing. In my view, we must expand to incorporate other types of debt that were not traditionally envisioned in the National Credit Act, such as debt owed to small businesses, attorneys of medical practices, schools, private schools, body corporates, municipalities, and other places. In many countries, that is allowed because we if we don't allow for that, we're actually not getting the full picture of the debt profile of the individual. We're getting a tiny sliver. And I would argue these days that the share of the debt that is that consumers owe to registered entities, credit providers, is much lower than the share of the debt that they owe to other entities, either unregistered lenders, people taking, you know, direct deductions from salaries, or municipalities, or, the phone companies, or whatever you have, you know, in the traditional sense. So we're kind of losing out as an industry, and you know, lenders are also losing out. So is the government, by the way, in terms of getting repayments back. So I would say those are some of the top of mind amendments. There are many other technical things, I think, that can be done to make it more customer centric. But also that would allow for the effective mechanism for the lenders and the consumers to feel like this is the right choice for them. I think we touched on the fees bits. I think for the fees, they're very reasonable in our opinion. But where there is an opportunity is to simplify the fee structures and things like that to make it easier to understand for everyone, rather than having like all kinds of different itemized billing, so to speak, have like one or two that is easy for people to understand. You know, in most cases, we're seeing people who get clearances is about 54, 55 months on average. But of course, there are some who finish within 2 years. There's some who finish at 7 years. I think that's been quite steady, I would say. And one of the reasons for it is that DCRS, we use DCRS extensively at DebtBusters, and that is optimizing for getting the capital back for unsecured debt within 5 years. So that's what it's designed for, and it's achieving that end. So I think that's well done, what was intended for versus what's being achieved. It's pretty close to each other. If you say 54, 55 months is within 60, that's great. So I think one of the things that, for me, like above all else of that, the requirement for initial and ongoing registration of debt counselors needs to be up significantly. I think that's probably one of the biggest gaps. Being a debt counselor, getting that license, so to speak, in South Africa is probably one of the most important things that one can have in the financial services. It, in my opinion, it ranks higher than a CFP or any other qualification. Why? Because you've got the ability, if you wanted to either shut someone out of the credit market, or you know, take over on their behalf to rearrange their finances. It's a huge responsibility, and it must come with the same obligation that is, you know, on par with that responsibility. And right now, the initial requirements, the work requirements, the ongoing sort of renewals, all of that, in my opinion, is far too low. It must be much, much higher. It must be, you know, somewhere between NQF 7 or 8 level, at least, you know, equivalent. I know there's been some discussion about making it, but there's, you know, if we are going to professionalize this industry and help many more people, which, by the way, we believe the number of people in debt counseling should be double of what it is today on an ongoing basis. The only way to get there is to professionalize the industry, increase the entry bar in such a way that you're not attracting as many scammers as we are today, whose, you know, primary purpose is to make a bit of money in with the, you know, in the initial fees and then kind of disappear, and actually clean up our own act. So I think that is a must. Whether that happens with regulation or whether that happens because we ourselves as an industry really want to set the bar, I don't know, but probably a bit of both. So I think that would also give a sense of more of a sense of comfort to the consumers on the other side about the transparency of what's being provided and the professional service, you know, and make sure that more and more of them are coming into the fold.
A little bit earlier, Vinay, you mentioned about the three banks were a little bit negative last year. And I mean, we always have critics that criticizes the industry. How do you respond to negative comments about our industry?
I think it's very easy to sort of paint everyone with the same brush. And I think like we said, the people who are, there's a disconnect between the people, particularly in the banks. There's a disconnect between people who run the debt review departments and the people who do the credit risk and have to report on credit losses and provisions and things like that. There's a disconnect. You know, the reality is that that disconnect is probably going to be impossible to close. That's one. The second thing is that I feel the people who are working for banks should do, not just banks, but all lenders, should do much more to actually segment the different debt counselors now that there's an established 15-year track record of people being in the business. They must do a more of a segmentation to really know how they manage the different groups of debt counselors and focus on those underperforming. I mean, the thing is, they have practical experience in this. They have what they, almost all banks have what they call external debt collectors. You know, they'll have panels of people, they will ask them to collect non-performing debt and this and that. And they manage those entities, you know, very ruthlessly, and they'll have specific targets. And if you don't perform, you'll be kicked out of the sort of panel and so on. Now, in this case, what they need to do is actually segment the debt counselors into the top performers, middle, bottom, whatever the segmentation is, actually manage it on that fashion and really focus in, rather than saying everybody's bad, because what that's what we're hearing. That may not be their intent, but that's what we are hearing. Rather than saying everyone is bad, everyone is a scammer, actually recognize the fact that just like in any other industry, there's going to be some people who shoot the lights out and there's going to be some people who are nowhere in terms of their performance, and try to like be specific about who is not performing and either engaging with them directly, which is typically the South African way rather than publicly, and try to get them to a better place and work with those entities specifically. But at the same time, you know, don't try to scare consumers completely away from a debt remedy solution that is put in the act. I mean, what I find interesting is that we have a debt remedy solution in debt counseling, debt restructuring, and it's the only one available to consumers, generally speaking. And yet we can have some group of registrants of telling the public not to use this debt remedy. So now my question to them would be, what would be the alternative? Another loan? I don't think so. So what would be the alternative for those individuals? What do we suggest that they do if they are struggling to repay back their debt, or if they think that they're going to struggle? Again, I think we always forget this point. The Act makes a provision for those who may face difficulties. And I think that's the part that usually goes amiss, again, with some of the credit risk people. You know, they tend to overlook that point. And their definition of someone facing difficulty is, are you in arrears or not? Well, it's not as simple as that, is it? So I think, one needs to, I don't have an answer for you for this question, but I think we must understand that, you know, in any complicated industry as ours, where there are lots of different players, you will have some who will not do the right thing. And we need to, all of us actually work to try to eliminate that, which is actually the view that our association has taken. We've been quite vocal about this. And I think we need everyone else to be vocal about it too.
Okay, well, we couldn't agree more, you know. But maybe let's put it all together now. We said it's National Debt Awareness Month, so people are going to look at their debt. We've said the debt review has improved over time, so this is definitely an option. And like you're saying, it's one of the options now, right? And now we've said, okay, you've got expertise and systems in place that can really help people. But as mentioned, there's been a little bit of this negative or maybe misinformation. If someone were to pick up the phone now and say to you, Benai, what do I do? I've got a lot of debt. Is debt review right for me? What do you say?
I mean, I would say go and have an assessment done. And see whether, you know, and that assessment should be no obligation. It should be done in a transparent way with you, so that you can see what the outcome of the assessment is, and then see whether it's the right solution for you. I mean, the question one needs to answer is, are you over indebted or are you overstretched? If you're over indebted, then of course debt counseling is a solution for you. If you are overstretched, then the advice should focus on, well, how can you actually help you? If you're overstretched but not over indebted, that is it that you made some bad choices? For example, do you have a fancy car that you need to trade down for something different because, you know, you cannot afford the expenses? You know, it needs to be done in that light. I think the first step is to get a proper assessment done. And to be fair, there aren't a lot of places in SA where you're going to get an assessment done for you for free. You know, you're not going to go to your bank to do an assessment for you because they don't have any, you know, they don't really have the sort of perhaps the inspiration, but that's not really what they offer. And you need to go to what you deem to be an independent, transparent party to do an assessment for you, for your finances, particularly your cash flow, and then say, okay, you are a candidate for this or you're not a candidate for it. I think that would be the first thing to do. And then, you know, see what options there are for you.
In terms of, let me put it this way. If we had to give you a magic wand right now, and we say, Vinay, you can wave this magic wand and Debt Review could change one thing in an instant right now, and going forward it'll be like that, what would you say? What would you change?
Is this specific to debt counseling? Okay. So specific to debt counseling. What would I change? You know, what would I change? It's a good question. I think we discussed some of the ideas. I would say, like, if I have one thing, the only thing right now, the thing I would do is change the make it more rigorous in terms of who we are allowing to register and stay on as a debt counselor. Make sure that they have a demonstrated ability and track record of helping people financially via apprenticeship or whatever, that they have the right level of qualification. That would be the only thing that if I have one thing to change, I think we need to be very introspective on this as debt counselor and say the bar isn't high enough. And that would be that's what I would change.
Now, before we let you go, you've spent some time looking at stats. Is there anything that's really standing out in your stats that you want to share, and something that's really like, wow, I actually didn't see this before?
I mean, you want good or bad stats, Corey?
a bit of both, I suppose. So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, so one thing we started doing more recently is kind of looking at different types of credit arrangements that people have. I did not realize that 52% of the people who apply for debt counseling would be applying with a one-month loan or would come with a one-month loan. To me, that was quite shocking, I must say. It is so high. I did not expect that. So, you know, that was surprising to me. It was very surprising. And, you know, maybe, yeah, maybe I shouldn't. But, you know, on a negative side. On the positive side, our consumers who completed debt counseling in Q4 2024, just that consumer group who completed debt counseling during that three-month period, again, not the full book, over the course of their debt counseling journey, that consumer group alone paid almost 700 million rand in terms of debt repayments to creditors. Now, our consumer base overall last year in 2024, this is the Debt Busters base, they paid over 4.5 billion rand to creditors. Okay. If you think about what can we do with 4.5 billion rand, I mean, I cannot even imagine what that would look like in a room. Imagine all the 200 rand, you know, things stacked in a, I don't know, wherever in a room. It probably will fill the room. But that 4.5 billion could be, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of new businesses that could help, you know, spur on several thousand new jobs. You know, like it could be It could be a matter of life and death for someone who is really desperate for that. It could be another extension of, economic activity. You know, it could be a lifeline for many others. So for me, that is why what we do, we do what we do. It's amazing stat. And, you know, we're hoping that 4.5 billion will be much more this year. So I think I'm an optimist about where we can grow. I think there's huge potential in terms of where we can go. And I think we must all work together as an industry to really make it grow much, much bigger than what it is today.
So we've appreciated spending this time together. Thank you, Benai. Thank you, Corey. We've got some real insights.
Great.
I feel a little bit smarter than when we began our podcast today. You know, as dummies, we need this information. It helps us gain a better understanding of what's going on. And I think if you are a consumer listening to this interview, maybe we dived into some heavy stuff there. But the message really is that debt review is working. See if it works for you. But, you know, get a clearer understanding of what's happening right now with your finances, with your debt. Don't leave it. Take action now rather than later. I like your comment, a decision today is better than a decision tomorrow, right? So thank you, Benai.
Yeah, definitely. The longer you wait, the fewer options you have. I think that's the reality. So make sure you tackle this early on. Thank you, guys.
I want to echo what Benai said in terms of doing an assessment. I think consumers should understand that we are there for them. We are not there to just make money. We're there to help the consumer. We really, really want them to feel safe that they go to a debt counselor. We'll do the assessment for them and just ask the questions before you just go ahead and decide on it. And I want to echo what Benai said then. Go and do the assessments.
Benai, we just want to say thank you so much for giving us your time. We really appreciate it and those insights into what's happening in the industry. And if people say, hey, this company sounds like a really nice company, maybe I want to ask them for an evaluation to check out my situation. How do people get hold of you guys?
Well, I think go to the DebtBusters website, debtbusters.co.za, or you can call in 086-999-0606. I would say the website is best because then you can actually sign for your free profile and see what your finances are like without, you know, some people like to do this on their own initially. And I think, you know, if you want to do it on your own time because life's pressing, then that's the place to start.
But Benai, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate you spending some time with us, dummies.
Great to be on your show and my first podcast. Thanks, guys.
Well, Corey, that was great. It was so good to hear from Benai there. You can hear that he's really passionate about the industry and always thinking about what comes next. How do we improve our service to consumers? How do we improve the level of service that's been provided? And yeah, very nice time we got to spend there. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I agree, Zach. It's nice to speak to one of the larger companies in South Africa when it comes to debt review. I think they see different side of debt review to when you're a bit smaller. It's nice to see the kind of perspective from the larger point of view. And you can see there's a lot of stats going on there. And I think that's what resonated with me is the stats. And I think that's so important that we can learn from our industry and learn through the stats. It's very important, I think.
Yeah, and amazing to hear some of the stats about the people finishing up their debt review, but also the value of money that's been moved through the debt review process back into the economy. And we will just say once again, it's National Debt Awareness Month. If you are a little unsure about your debts, grab a pen and paper, grab all your statements, write it down, figure out how much you owe, who you owe money to. And if you're having a little bit of trouble with that, if you're not sure, talk to a debt counselor. A debt counselor is an expert at handling debt stuff, so they can always go through those figures with you. They'll be happy to set some time aside. And once you have a holistic view of what's going on with your debt, they can give you advice about what's next steps. How do you avoid things getting worse? How can you make sure things get better? And what options do you have?
Yeah, and I agree also with a lot of stuff that he mentioned about around the vehicle finance, you know, negotiate on interest rates, look what you're paying, also factor in the cost of the insurances and the maintaining of the vehicle and all of those things. I think that for me was also very, very important when it comes to financial wellness, not just looking at unsecured debt, but when it comes to vehicle finance. And you can also see that Binay is very passionate about that.
Well, as I said, I feel a little bit smarter than when we started. I think these are things that we can all do. So thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Binay. We really appreciate his time. Zach, again, thank you very much for your time. Thank you to our listeners. And we'll see you on the next episode of Debt Review with Dummies.
Da-da-dum.